This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. Though our program will be taking us far beyond the studio, where I'll be joined by co-host Pat Schlarbaum, and I'll be taking a road trip with Paul Wearson to Teen Maze at the Boone County Fairgrounds. We'll close the show with a preview of Ankeny Community Theater's next play, A Few Good Men. Before we get started with the forum that Pat is bringing us, I have to report on one of his cherished projects, the Decorah Eagles. He told me the second eaglet has hatched and the third has pipped, which means it is expected to hatch today.
On December 18, 2017, a water quality forum was recorded at the Ames Municipal Auditorium. Speakers from across Iowa presented their concerns for clean water in Iowa. One of the voices was Wally Taylor, an environmental lawyer and director of the Sierra Club in Iowa. Specifically, Mr. Taylor addressed CAFOs, or confinement animal feeding operations, and their impacts on Iowa's agricultural communities. Their impacts on water quality, not only to Iowa, but in the lower reaches of the Mississippi watershed in the Gulf of Mexico, were included. Since 2002, Iowa hog producers have been allowed to proliferate when the tenets of a master matrix are completed. The master matrix is the legal paperwork that allows a CAFO to be constructed in our communities. The DNR, or Iowa Department of Natural Resources, has governmental control of the master matrix that producers address to receive a permit for a CAFO, or confinement animal feeding operation. This is Wally Taylor, an advocate for clean water.
Hi, I'm Wally Taylor. I'm an attorney from Cedar Rapids, and I'm on the executive committee of the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club has been fighting CAFOs for almost 30 years now, ever since the CAFO industry first started. I think, first of all, we have to understand what's going on here. People used to raise hogs like Chris is raising them. And we're talking about mostly hogs. There's cattle and dairy and poultry as well, but it's the hogs that are the real problem. And big companies like Smithfield, Murphy, Prestige, Iowa Select, Cargill, you name them all, Synergy, decided that they could force family farmers in Iowa through the economics of concentration and controlling the market to force these farmers to either get big or get out. And that's what's happened. Then, when people started complaining, the industry, the pork producers and the Farm Bureau, went to the legislature and got laws restricting nuisance suits, establishing these separation distances and all of these other requirements, if you want to call them that, that were designed by the industry, and the infamous matrix. Let me tell you what's wrong with the matrix. First of all, as has been said, 50% is a passing score. In most places, that would be an F, not a passing score. And there are questions on the matrix that can be manipulated. For example, there's one question that asks, have you ever had an enforcement violation? Well, if you're just starting out in the CAFO industry, no, you haven't had. So you get a point for that, even though it doesn't mean a darn thing because you haven't been in a situation where you would have a violation. It asks, is there a well? Well, is it a deep well? Is it a shallow well? We don't know, and it makes a difference. Those are the kinds of questions that skew the matrix. And the matrix depends on the county supervisors. Now, many county supervisors are very knowledgeable, and they really want to do the right thing with this matrix. A lot of supervisors, particularly smaller counties, just don't have the knowledge and the resources available to them to really deal with the matrix. And then there are supervisors who don't want to touch the hot potato at all, and they just pass it and send it on to the DNR. That's one problem with having the supervisors be in charge of the matrix process. Another problem is that if the supervisors pass the matrix, but citizens think that it should not have passed, or that there's some other reason that the county should oppose the construction of the CAFO, the citizens can't appeal. The supervisors have to appeal. The citizens, who are the ones who are adversely affected, have no voice. They can't appeal. They can't do anything. They have to beg their supervisors to do the right thing. So the Sierra Club supports doing away with the matrix altogether. There's no fix to it. Let's just do away with it altogether and have real local control. Then the problem with that is that the legislature has allowed the state to preempt county control. There was a case several years ago. The Sierra Club filed what's called an amicus brief. The county health department in one of the north central counties passed some ordinances that they said were health ordinances, not regulation of CAFOs per se, and not regulating agriculture. They were health ordinances. And the Farm Bureau and the pork producers challenged those ordinances, and the court said, yes, those are regulating agriculture, and it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court agreed that the state had preempted the county control. So the bottom line here is, if you leave here tonight with nothing else having been learned, remember, the problem is the state legislature. So we as citizens need to confront our legislator. Every chance you get, confront them. Make them understand CAFOs are an issue. We don't want CAFOs, and they need to do something about it. Most legislators have forums every other week or so. Go to those forums. Let the legislators know that the CAFOs are an important issue to you and that you're going to make sure that those legislators listen to you. And then finally, as Jess said, there's an election coming up next year. Let's be citizens. Let's do more than just vote. Let's make sure CAFOs are a campaign issue so the legislators know they can't get by with the not mentioning CAFOs because they figure that it won't be a campaign issue. Let's make it a campaign issue. Another thing the legislature has done, I'm not done yet with the legislature, they have passed what's called a stringency clause. State law cannot be more stringent than federal law. And the Federal Clean Water Act, although we were able to at least use it to a certain extent to get the DNR to do some enforcement, the problem with the federal law is that the Clean Water Act does not effectively regulate CAFOs. An NPDES permit simply says you cannot discharge pollutants into a water of the United States without an NPDES permit. It doesn't say you have to get one. It just says if you discharge without a permit, you're in violation. Okay, so the CAFOs, we know they're going to discharge somehow or other sometime. We just don't know when or how. It isn't like the city wastewater plant or an industry that knows they're going to be discharging pollutants every day, a certain amount every day, or at least a controlled discharge, and they know what they're going to be discharging when and where. But what the courts have said is that with regard to CAFOs, you cannot force them to get an NPDES permit. So if they're taking the risk that they will either not have a discharge, or if they do, they'll just pay the fine and go on doing business. Again, there's an election coming up for Congress. Let our congressional candidates know that they need to amend the Clean Water Act so that it effectively regulates CAFOs. Another federal law that is starting to be used is what's called the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. The Solid Waste Disposal Act is another name for it. And if this waste that's put on the crop fields is more than the crops can take in. The excess is waste, and it's discharged off of the land. That waste must be controlled according to the federal law. But so far, and we're going to try to change that, is that nobody has challenged that. We think that this federal law applies to CAFOs and the waste that's discharged on the land. You know, think about what a CAFO is. It's a wastewater system. Pigs discharge their waste, if that's a nice way to put it, into this big pit under the building. Every 6 months to a year, that waste is taken out of the pit and applied to the crop fields untreated. And a pig produces as much waste as five humans. A 10,000-head CAFO is 50,000 humans. What is Ames? Is Ames 50,000 now or more? Imagine if the city of Ames didn't have a wastewater treatment plant. That's what we're looking at. And the legislature, I get back to the legislature all the time, has adopted a special chapter in the Iowa Code for animal feeding operation, separate from and exclusive of the wastewater chapter in the Iowa Code. CAFOs need to be under the regulation and the authority of the wastewater law, because that's what they are. They're a wastewater system. Again, confront your legislators. Make sure we get some laws in this state that force or let, however you want to say it, the DNR do its job, and that CAFOs are regulated so that they do not harm the environment. We can do it.
You've been listening to Wally Taylor, an attorney and executive board member for the Iowa Sierra Club. Next, we will hear remarks from members of the audience at a water quality forum that brought a panel of speakers to Ames to discuss confinement animal feeding operations and water quality issues they create in the Mississippi and Missouri River watersheds in our beautiful state of Iowa.
Good to see you, sir.
Yeah.
And your name? And
Selden Spencer.
And what's your address?
Well, I'm down in Huxley.
Uh-huh.
823 Ashwood.
What brings you out this evening?
Well, I came because this was advertised as a presentation about CAFOs and water quality, and those are issues that are very important to me.
And what was your best take-home
message? Well, I think some of the legal analysis was good. And I think some of the things the Sierra Club were trying to, the way he described the whole matrix and how it's really flawed, mm-hmm. I think that was very valuable. I think also the push to try and get back to supervisor county authority over the siting and placements of CAFOs was very good. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think the the idea on the Iowa legislative, that's the real platform we have to be able to tackle. We have to be able to get legislators in there that will address this issue. And bills, very practical ideas from the one presenter on bills that we as citizens should be trying to promote, trying to get them in committee so that they can be analyzed and hopefully lead to some better control over a rampant industry that's very destructive to our state.
Really great points. Did you miss anybody? I do understand this is the third in a series, and there will be others.
No, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was very fluky. I did see the advertisement, and unfortunately I got here just a little late, but very, very good information, very solid, and I hope they could get this out. Actually, I was kind of halfway hoping that the whole event was recorded.
It is.
Oh, okay. So yeah. You can get it available to people, and they can review it. A lot of good information. Horrible, tough problem, and a little scary in the sense of where is this going, you know, and we don't have any control over it all, and I don't want to be, you know, you think about the analogy of oil and refineries and how they totally destroy communities. This is what we're facing too, a CAFO industry that destroys communities. So anyway. Hope we can get some.
I hope you're empowered to contact your legislator.
I think that's the main take home. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
And your name and address?
Susan Heathcote in Des Moines, Iowa.
And a lot of people know you from the Iowa Environmental Council service that you provide the community. What brings you out this evening?
Well, I mean, livestock issues in Iowa are really coming to a head here. We've been seeing expanding livestock facilities across the state of Iowa, and we keep thinking that maybe we've, you know, can turn the corner here, and people are going to start to say this is too much, and some of our other resources are at risk, our drinking water, our recreational waters. We were just talking, some of the panelists today were talking about outrageous situations where we have these large confinements going into some of our most vulnerable areas of the state, where we have shallow bedrock and cold water trout streams that would be at risk from pollution coming from these facilities. And what we're putting at risk is the economic resources of that are probably the most important resources in that area, which is tourism and quality of life, that people are attracted to those areas for that purpose. We have people coming from not just from Iowa but from all over the country to enjoy those resources, and we're putting them at risk. It's just, you know, to me, this is a tipping point. We have gone too far. And we are a farm state. We are an agricultural state. But this isn't agriculture anymore.
This is a series. This is the third panel discussion that was on top of Decorah and Cedar Rapids. I believe there'll be more. What area, is there something that might add a certain dimension that was overlooked?
Well, I tell you what, they had a wonderful panel. I think we touched on a lot of the issues. I think one of the things that is so important as the perspective of the traditional farmers who, Chris Peterson, who spoke about the way we always raised hogs in Iowa. I grew up in Hamilton County, and again, we've traditionally had a lot of hog production when I was growing up in that area of the county. And farmers were some of the wealthiest people in our community. And it was because they had, you know, diversified farms, and the livestock was worth a lot more. And the value of hogs has gone way down with the volume that we're producing now, with these large corporations dominating the marketplace. The value to the individual farmers has gone way down. So what are we protecting in terms of, you know, we're saying that we're an agricultural state, and livestock production is a very important part of our economy. That's very true, and it's always been a very important part of our economy. The question is who's benefiting from that economic value? Is it local producers who take that economic return for their products that they're producing on their farm and recycle through the local economy, or is it being exported out of the state? And what's being left behind are the problems. We're seeing declining rural populations. We're seeing quality of life in rural areas. Whoever thought living in the country? You always think, what? Live in the country, fresh air, healthy living, you know, and then a big confinement goes up, and all of a sudden your quality of life has gone down. What are we doing to our state? And what is going to be the result if we don't put the brakes on this thing and put some balance back in the decision-making about where we should be locating facilities? What are the holding capacity of the land in terms of concentration? Somebody said today that we could have double the number of hogs that we currently have in Iowa according to our current state permitting rules, and what would that be like? You know, it's scary. You know, I feel like this is a time for us to speak up and let our legislators know that quality of life and rural economic development for individual, you know, family farmers has been sold out for corporate interests, and that is not going to lead us to a good end in terms of the kinds of things that we've always valued in Iowa, which is hard work and neighborliness and caring for the land and for the resources is really kind of what it's all about in rural Iowa. And we're losing that with when we export our quality of life and trade that off for somebody else's economic development.
You have been listening to a water quality forum recorded by Susan Franson on December 18, 2017. Thank you, Susan. Voices were Dr. Sheldon Spencer from Huxley and Susan Heathcote from Des Moines with the Iowa Environmental Council. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
Thanks, Pat. Our next stop is the Teen Maze, which Paul Wearson and I visited on Monday.
This is Paul Wearson, co-host with Susan Franson, and we are at the 8th annual Teen Maze here at the fairgrounds in Boone. And I'd like to welcome Jerry Bug, who is the person who's been involved with Kiwanis from the outset. Jerry, in a nutshell, describe Teen Maze.
Okay. Teen Maze is an experiential learning opportunity for seventh graders in Story Boone in Greene County. It happens once a year. These are kids that may have had some programming already in their schools about adolescent pregnancy prevention, substance abuse prevention, life skills, and they're coming here for an experience, and YSS partners with Division 11 Kiwanis. So the kids are not only hearing it at home, at school, but also from community members.
And this experience, well, full disclosure, I was a Kiwanian for years in Story City, and I was here at the beginning, too, and I remember all the efforts that you made, Jerry, mm-hmm. to make this happen, because there are all kinds of agencies who are participating. You might name a few of law enforcement. There are several that are involved.
Yes. We could not do without the partners. There is law enforcement from every county, every city within that Story Boone and Greene County. There are lawyers, judges. We have one judge who travels from Des Moines every year to participate. He's here today, actually. There are, this year, Iowa State University is doing our parent land. We have the State Association of Eating Disorders doing a track also this year. And Access has been a partner, 4-H, Extension.
Well, now what happens is highly experiential, because the kids enter the maze and go through this maze, mm-hmm. and every station on the maze depicts some problem or thing that we want to teach the kids. So it's really a hands-on experience. Mm-hmm. And one of the most dramatic things is, I know just from leading kids through, are the lungs of someone who died of cigarette smoking. The kids look at that and say, wow.
Yeah, that is. That makes an impression. We are able, through our partners at Story County Medical, to provide a lung that, from a healthy cadaver lung and then a diseased cadaver lung, and the kids could actually touch it. That area also has some software where one youth volunteers to be the smoker, and we have the software that ages them from their 14 to what they'll look like at 60 if they smoke. So that's
so
pretty dramatic.
And mm-hmm. they take a picture of their face, and then here's this countenance all wrinkled and
yeah,
worn.
Yeah, it's pretty impactful when you're a teenager and worried about how you look. So.
Well, you know, the thing is, too, there's a juvenile court, and that's actually
yes.
a jail.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids become pregnant. Others
yes.
actually have children in a carrier they have to mm-hmm. carry around with them, which really highlights the fact that if you have a child, especially at a young age, suddenly you leave the ranks of a normal teenager and become a mom or dad. And so these are very graphic illustrations. If they wear a pregnancy harness, they know what it means to be pregnant.
Yes, and then that plays out throughout the maze. So if they are a parent and in the party room they get busted for drug use and go see the lawyer, DHS may take the baby away. So we try to, you know, it's only a 10 minutes per stop, but boy, we make a power, pack a lot into it.
Well, another thing that impresses me is the portion that talks about budgeting, how to shop wisely, and how retailers present different mm-hmm. bargains and everything, and the kids are educated about how to shop wisely, budget wisely, and do all these things that eventually will be their responsibility. So I like the real, live, hands-on experience.
Now, absolutely, and that's where we get those partners, the banks.
They're dealing with real life
Vision
people.
Bank has people from all those branches in those communities that the kids come from, and that's what's exciting. They're seeing their neighbor in their field. We do a social media one that talks about how the impact of what you post could impact whether you have get a job or lose a job.
Yeah, it's so graphic.
And because, mental health,
well,
too.
Well, for kids this age, to see, you know, one picture is worth 1,000 words. One experience might be worth 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they have a lot of this experiential, hands-on, eyes-on contact, they're able to perceive the problem and start thinking about the planning and decision-making they need to do. That's the whole idea of Teen Maze, isn't it?
It is, and we do evaluations. We've done evaluations from day one, and 90% of the kids on a pretty consistently say, this will change my behavior, this has impacted me. And we're in the process of doing a longer range evaluation to see if it really did.
Now today, this is Monday.
This is Monday.
This is the first day of Teen Maze, and what schools are here today?
Today we're just running in the morning, which is unusual, and we just have Roland Story in Ogden School District.
And then tomorrow, what's going on? You look like it's going to be a big day tomorrow.
Tomorrow, I believe, is Ballard and some other smaller schools. Greene County will be here on Wednesday. Ames will be here Thursday, and Boone Schools and some other schools on Friday. So almost 1,200 kids will go through in 5 days.
That's terrific. Look at your impact and how many kids
are. Absolutely.
And to remind everybody at home, this is a seventh grade program. All the children here are from seventh grade, and they're from various schools, and not just one county either. They're from Boone and Greene County also.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it that once a school experiences this, they stick around, don't they?
Everyone
repeats.
They do. You know, the very first year we did it, which was 2011, we'd gone through some training, we had the concept, but we really did not know if we knew what we were doing. And the amazing thing is almost all the school districts bought in, sight unseen.
It wasn't hard to sell the program.
It was not at all hard. We worked through Kiwanis, and if you remember in Story City, we worked through the school board, you know, so we had our Kiwanians out there really trying to help us sell the program.
And once you have the momentum, then you are really in business because they repeat every year.
They do.
In Roland Story, I know that it's a sibling thing. If their older brother or sister went through Teen Maze, they wouldn't hear of not doing it themselves.
Right, right.
So it's self-perpetuating, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, parents certainly have the option to not send their child to Teen Maze.
Well, so basically it's a question of, you know, parents wanting their children to have this experience. They can opt out, like a lot of things, they can opt out.
Right, and we've had homeschool parents come in, check it out. We do some of the Boone County religious schools, and we'll tone some certain things down. The part where we talk about sex, it's all age appropriate, and we certainly push abstinence. I had a parent call me the other day and wondered if we were handing out condoms.
Oh, yeah.
And I assured him it's very developmentally appropriate. These are, you know, where they're learning in school already, so we're not.
What I really like, though, is that in many of the parts of the Teen Maze, they're actually getting educated by people who work in that field every
Correct.
Day.
Correct.
And yeah, I'm very impressed you have a judge here, too.
That is very cool. Yeah, the lawyers, the judges, the mental health, we do one on suicide.
Well, you know, the thing is, what I'm impressed with is, and I'm not really clear on, is how these kids draw lots. Like, certain number of them are going to be pregnant. Certain number of them are going to have. Is that a chip thing they draw or what? How do they do
You
it?
Know, the very first year, it was the spin of the wheel or whatever. And what we found is that if you drew and you became pregnant, you may be bullied when you get back to school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we went to volunteers.
Oh, okay.
And we try to not get the same youth volunteering to be pregnant, to be the smoker, and to get arrested.
So that could really have ramifications
back
at the school.
Yeah.
That's probably wise, because you do see kids with the pregnancy harness and kids carrying babies in a carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whether you're the one actually doing that or if there are other children around you going through the maze see that, the lessons learned.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah,
and so we don't have to jump on them with both feet. They just see from what's possible.
You know, YSS kind of manages this for the Kiwanis group. That's the kind of relationship that I like to say. And we are constantly changing. You know, after this morning, I'll bet you some of these newer groups that are partnering, they're going to change up what they're doing because 10 minutes is quick.
The important thing is you're always seeking feedback.
That's right.
When you get feedback, you improve the program. You alter the program. You make adjustments. Mm-hmm. And something always presents itself that you haven't thought of. Even though you're here 8 years, you can always refine that. So how would you do anything but improve, right?
Right. A great example is social media. We used to talk a lot about Facebook. Kids don't do Facebook.
So you have
they
to
Snapchat.
Update Snapchat.
Yeah, or Twitter or whatever. But
yeah, you have to be with it, don't you?
You do. You do. That's why we have young staff.
Well, just to talk about the volunteerism going on here, you have volunteers from everywhere, but predominantly I see there's a nice little break room where you've got all kinds of food, and I know you coordinate getting all the food here for the volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so there would be Kiwanians from several clubs here. Is that right?
That's right. You know, it is Story County and Ogden Day, so we've got a lot of the Roland Kiwanis Club members here, but also some of the other clubs. The food, Kiwanians not only provide hundreds of hours of volunteer time, it takes about 3,000 hours to put this together.
3,000 hours mm-hmm. of volunteer. Oh.
So they not only are volunteering, they are also providing dollars. A club takes a meal every day. The other smaller clubs bake the cookies because we do like our cookies.
Oh, here we are, Teen Maze, and the Roland Story crew has gone through the maze today, and we're interviewing now our principal at Roland Story Middle School, Brian Towne. Brian, tell us about your experience today.
Yeah, this was my first time at Teen Maze. Last year I wasn't able to go, and this year I wanted to attend, one, to kind of supervise kids, but two, just to learn a little bit about the program and to see what it offers for our students, and it was a great experience today. Kids were led through a variety of different activities about choices that they'll have to make in their lives moving forward as young men and women, and had the opportunity to learn about what those would look like.
What did you think about the adults and tremendous volunteer work here that's being done by a number of folks?
Yes, absolutely amazing. I know that a large number of YSS volunteers as well as Kiwanis groups from around the counties that came to help out, so tremendous support for our students.
What particularly impressed you when you watched the kids go through? You went through the entire maze, I take it. What stuck in your mind mostly?
Probably student engagement, just seeing our students being involved with answering questions, being a part of the activities, and working hard to learn a lot of important information.
So you think our students behaved well?
Yes, absolutely. It didn't surprise me one bit. We have great kids.
Well, just to verify that, we have three Roland Story kids here. And the first one I'm going to talk to, give your name.
Luke Patton.
Well, Luke, tell us about your experience. What did you like best about Teen Maze?
Probably the Jeopardy, just because you got to interact with a lot of like social media stuff, and pretty fun to interact with all your friends doing that and stuff.
Did you encounter any problems from adult life that involved you?
No, not much other than just like don't do drugs, don't do alcohol, no cigarettes, all that.
So you didn't draw a bad card and end up in juvenile court or anything?
Oh, I did. I went to prison for 3 years.
You went to prison for three? My sympathy. You're going to love eating off a tray. Now, we have another young man here. Give us your name.
Cooper.
And Cooper, what stood out in your mind about the Teen Maze? First of all, did you like it? Did you like the experience?
Yeah, it was fun. And what? The juvenile court was really fun.
It was? Now, you didn't go to jail, did you?
No.
Yeah, but you learned about financial planning, too, and that sort of thing. What was your favorite part of the team?
The juvenile court.
Juvenile court. And you learned a lot about financial management and all the decisions you have to make as a teenager and some of the bad outcomes. So you learned something today.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And would you recommend it to other seventh graders?
Yeah.
And our third person here, give your name.
Isaiah Naylor.
Well, Isaiah, tell me about your experience in Teen Maze.
It was a really good experience.
What really stood out in your mind about what you want to take home from this or remember?
Don't do drugs.
And also, some other life decisions. It kind of covered everything, didn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you went through the Teen Maze, and there were several stations. How did you like the way it was laid out, and did it make sense to you?
Yeah, it made plenty of sense.
And someone led you through the maze, so you had a Kiwanian volunteer to carry a sign, and you followed them through the maze?
Yeah.
And you learned a lot. Mm-hmm. So here at Teen Maze, we have not only three young men who enjoyed the experience, but also learned a lot about life. And I think that our principal, too, Brian Towne of Roland Story, is impressed with this program. And this means the old seventh grade will be back next year, right, Brian?
Yep, we'll definitely be back next year, for sure.
That's very good. Teen Maze here at Boone County Fairgrounds, and we've talked to three people here. Yes, Brian, want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing. I'm hoping that the things that the students learn today, they take home, and it sparks some good positive communication between our students and their parents when they get home. That's definitely something I hope kids get from this, and they have that communication with their parents.
Yeah, Brian, I'm glad you said that, because our earlier interview with Jerry Bug from the Kiwanis Club said how much happens back home. Mm-hmm. You know, it stimulates conversation, and there might be some questions the students have for their parents, and they might have some feedback on the program when they talk about it at home. So you see, it's not just a question of the experience, but what you take away and how that impacts your life. And so we have three boys here who will make good decisions all their lives, right, man?
Yes, sir.
All right, okay. And partially because of Teen Maze. And here you are in Boone County, and you have to go back to school today, right?
Yep.
And you're new people with new ideas. The whole afternoon will be different than the morning, right? Because you went through Teen Maze. Okay, thanks, guys. Thanks, Brian Towne.
Thank you very much.
From Roland Story Middle School.
The last event of Teen Maze was outside, and it was a driver of a tricycle with a basket on her handlebars. She had a cell phone in one hand and a Tootsie Pop in the other when someone threw a stuffed alligator across her path. Distracted Driving was the name of this event. And it made me think of a Peter Mayer song, Driving With My Knee.
Well, I'm talking on the cell phone in my hand right now, while the other hand's writing some directions down, and I'm driving my car. Wait, how can that be, you ask me? Hand number three. I'm driving with my knee, driving with my knee. I've got both hands free, driving with my knee. And I'm multitasking much more productively, driving with my knee. I bought a tuna fish sandwich and some crunch and munch, but I don't have to stop to have a little lunch. I grab the sandwich with my hand, pick up a newspaper and read, 'cause I'm driving with my knee. Driving with my knee, driving with my knee. I've got both hands free, driving with my knee. And I'm multitasking much more productively, driving with my knee. I get so excited with the time I save that I give the police a friendly two-handed wave, and I can tell by the sirens and the lights that they're happy for me when I'm driving with my knee. But then I start to think that I made a big mistake when they turn their car around and start coming my way. So I step on the gas, still holding my sandwich and tea. I'm speeding with my knee. That's right, speeding with my knee, speeding with my knee. Now I'm up around 93. I'm eating my lunch while escaping from the state police. Speeding with my knee. Driving with my knee, driving with my knee. I've got both hands free, multitasking much more productively. Driving with my knee. Driving with my knee. Driving with my knee. I got both hands free. Driving with my knee. And I'm multitasking much more productively. Driving.
Our last stop today is the Ankeny Community Theater. They're producing A Few Good Men, Alan Sorokin's 1989 Broadway play and 1992 Oscar-nominated film. I'm speaking with Michael Hollister, who is the director of A Few Good Men. Could you tell us why Ankeny Community Theater chose that play this year?
Ankeny Community Theater chose the play because I think they're trying to expand their boundaries a little bit, to try more challenging theater pieces, and this is definitely one of those shows that does that.
Why?
It's challenging in a way that there's multiple locations, multiple settings in the play, and the scene changes from one scene to another happen very quickly, and in order to keep pace with the play, those scene changes have to be quick and suggested, but at the same time, you don't want to become too minimalistic with the sets, or else you'll lose the flavor of each location.
When I saw that you were doing this play, I thought that, well, for one thing, of course, it's more serious than many of your plays, so it's a little harder for the audience to adjust if they're used to comedies. And the other reason is that, is there any political commentary or social commentary there with cover-ups?
Well, you know, that's very interesting. The seriousness of the piece is that it's very intense, and, you know, we didn't want to make any kind of comment on the military in general. I looked at the script as more of a microcosm of our society. To be honest, as an audience member, I don't particularly seek out military dramas or courtroom dramas to attend as an audience member. So when I volunteered to direct this, I had to approach it from a position of it just being a drama. And I didn't want to put the military on trial, so instead I decided to put the lawyer on trial. This is really a play about a person learning about honor and about standing up for what is right when everybody around him has a different definition of what is honorable and what is right.
How do you see the tension? Are there people who clearly are understanding honor and as opposed to those who simply want to make sure that nothing dishonorable gets on display?
We approached all of the characters as they were all doing what they believed was the right thing to do. Even the antagonist or the villain of the piece, we even looked at him from a sympathetic position of having to have had to do a very difficult job. However, he is the ends justifying the means. Doesn't help from a position of honor. What he's trying to accomplish is important, and what his priorities are honorable. It's just the means that he used to accomplish it eventually ended up in murder.
How did you happen to decide to do this play?
Ankeny Community Theater has a group of directors, and they solicit other directors to put in proposals to direct shows from the season. And they announce their season a year before, and you pick whatever shows you're interested in, you read the scripts, and then you write up a proposal as to how you're going to approach the play. I selected two of them, and A Few Good Men was one of my choices because I thought it would be a great challenge.
How do you work with the actors? Do you do anything to prepare them for this attitude that you have, that they all are doing the right thing in their own eyes?
Actually, yes. I briefly told them all at the very early standpoint, they are the voice of their character, and they all have to believe that they are doing the right thing. One of the things that we really worked on was having conversations with each other. Ankeny Community Theater does a lot of performance with the audience and breaking down that fourth wall and doing showcase-style theater. And this, I wanted to have it be much more personal, much more conversational, because they're talking about issues and behaviors and positions and standpoints of who they are and how they identify themselves. And each one is a different facet of society. And I think they all found that, and they were all able to make their characters relatable to themselves. And so in a lot of ways, you're, as an audience member, you're seeing the personality of the actor or the actress as they interpret the character.
Is that more true, do you think, when you know some of the actors off stage? I mean, not you, the director, but the audience members.
Yeah, I think audience members who are familiar with these actors and have seen them in other shows are going to be very excited by these performances, because it's they're going to see an aspect of that actor or that actress that they might not have had an opportunity to see in other shows, because they have so much at stake as the character. The character is defending their position to their best ability. Right or wrong, they are having to take a stand. And there's a lot of conflict and a lot of confrontation in this play, even between people who like each other.
Did you have a difficult time getting into the play? What were the early rehearsals like?
The early rehearsals were very much taking the characters in a scene. I would set a table in the middle of the rehearsal space, sit everybody around the table, and talk to each other as if there was no audience watching. And that way they could actually live in the moment with another actor. It was just between the two of them, and they talked to each other just like ordinary people do. And that has stuck with them all the way through the rehearsal process. And now when you're watching it on stage, it looks like you're watching a real moment between two real people.
How many plays have you directed for Ankeny Community Theater?
This is actually my first opportunity to direct for Ankeny Community Theater. Many years ago, I directed for Ingersoll Dinner Theater. I directed about three plays for Ingersoll. And then I took a hiatus for about 25 years to earn a living and to focus on my life and job, and you know how that is.
So is it good to be back?
I enjoy it. It's challenging, and it gives me an opportunity to express myself in a very personal, intimate way of letting an audience into my mind so that they can see how I see a script. What you see is what I imagine when I read it for the first time.
You mean that's what you see on the stage?
Yes, what you see on the stage is really letting you into my imagination as I was reading the script.
That's interesting. Sometimes you discover things as you become more familiar with the script. Was that not true for you?
In general, it's very much the same as what I envisioned when as I was reading it. But of course, you have to make compromises. You have to work with the cast that you do cast from auditions, and you find who they are as people, and what aspects that they share with the character that will help make the character real. And in general, it's very much the same show as what I read. The design of the set and the lights and everything, of course, is all done through the collaboration of other artists, but it's all making the same statement or the same mood or the same feel as when I was reading the play.
What would you say to the audience to make them feel that they don't want to miss this show?
I think the audience will want to come to see the show because it's unlike going to the movie or watching a film. It's a very safe environment when you go to a movie because it's already happened. You're just watching a recording of an event. When you come to the live theater and you see it on stage, only a few feet away from you, it's happening. It's you're there as it happens, as it unfolds. I compare theater to going to a wedding. You know what to expect, but it's very much present and it's very real. And you experience the soul of the person who's on stage as if it were happening for the first time.
Was it a disadvantage to be directing a play that many people know through the movie?
Yes. It's very, especially if you're one of the actors and you have seen the play or you've seen the movie, and it can be very intimidating if you love the movie, you're like, performance, or how am I going to bring something original to it and still have it be strong? And that was a big challenge for a lot of the actors. The other is you want to find aspects in the actor or in the actress that is unique into themselves and have them apply that to the character. And that's what helps them make it their own character, but still keep it pertinent to the script and a powerful character.
Could you give us the details that people need to know to put them on their calendars and to get some tickets?
The play is opening on Friday, April 6th, and it runs for 2 weekends. We have a Thursday show on April 12th. The show begins at 7:30, Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays, and at 2 o'clock on Sundays. And the doors open a half hour before showtime. I suggest coming early to get the best seat.
Where can they get tickets?
They can go to our website at AnconyCommunityTheater.com. Theater is spelled with a T-R-E, not T-E-R. Or they can go through Midwest Tix. And that phone number is 515-244-2771.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. Pat Schlarbaum and Paul Wearson hosted 2 segments. Other voices you heard were Wally Taylor, Sheldon Spencer, Susan Heathcote, Jerry Bug, Michael Hollister, Brian Town, and Roland Story 7th graders Luke Patton Cooper and Isaiah Naylor. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There, you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Driving with My Knee by Peter Mayer from his CD, Novelties. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.